Thank you. I figure since I arrived at 9:01 a.m., I will give everybody a little grace to take their seats. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the meeting of the Research, Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Affairs Committee. The meeting is called to order. Rachel, would you please call the roll?
Committee Vice Chair Athas.
Here.
Trustee Dennis Barcima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Here.
Trustee Tim Moore.
Here.
Trustee Bob Pritchard.
No, it'd be Trustee Lee Strong.
That should be not there.
Sorry, Trustee Eric Wazowitz.
Here.
And Committee Chair Veronica Herrera.
Here. Did we get everybody, though?
Trustee Leland Strong.
We did, yeah.
Here, thank you.
Thank you.
But we do like Bob.
We love Bob. Yes. Okay. Ms. Prairie, would you please confirm that the appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have quorum present?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to Illinois Open Meetings Act, and you do have a quorum of trustees present.
Great, thank you. Do we have to, may I have a motion to approve? Do we have to?
So moved.
Yes, okay.
Gales.
Gales, thank you. A second.
Second, Barcima.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Opposed? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Sorry, I was missing something on my script.
We're all opposed.
Thank you. Agenda is approved, then. May I have, oh, no, it's not. No, we just approved the quorum.
No, you did. There's a quorum present. Now you approved the meeting agenda for today.
Yes.
And now you need to do the minutes for today.
I didn't approve the agenda yet.
No, it's the next motion.
Yes.
Just to ask for a motion.
Okay, 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 yes. All right, we're on the same page. May I please have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So moved, Athas.
Second, Strong.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Opposed? Wonderful, motion passes. Next, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Wazowitz.
Thank you. A second?
Second, Barcima.
Thanks. Any discussion? All in. Yes.
These are the minutes of November.
November 9th, 2023.
2023, yeah.
Yes. Okay, any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Why are you opposed?
You are all throwing me off this morning. Kidding. Thank you. Okay, good. Motion passes for the approval of minutes of November 9th. I would like to welcome any University Advisory Committee representatives present today. And do you have any comments?
Just wanted to thank the Office of Sponsored Projects for all of the projects that I saw here in the packet. This money is vital for the research and collaboration that the faculty do. And I just wanted to extend my appreciation to that, to that office. Thank you.
Thank you. So next, we'll move to just some quick comments that I have. One is just wonderful to be here for our first RILA meeting of the year. We have lots of really amazing things to share today, including a continued trend of increased funding from both state and federal sources. And I really continue to be amazed at the commitment and excellence of the NIU faculty and staff, as well as Dara Little's team. And Vice President Harris will be sharing highlights of current initiatives and awards. And in addition, Brian Flower, Director of Food Innovation Systems, will be presenting an exciting partnership among NIU, ComEd, and the Electric Power Research Institute. And together, the collaborators are growing healthy food all year round and contributing to our regional food sustainability goals. You know, I'll just say that, you know, as we look through the report and we look at, you know, all of the awards and recognitions that you're about to hear about, it is really amazing how NIU has remained and continues to grow in terms of their position of how we approach new markets across the state, how we continue to grow growing markets across the state and become just be a key player in building the pipeline and developing the research in all of these areas. So I just really want to applaud all of the work we're doing and everyone that, you know, we're about to highlight. We'll highlight a little later. I'm really proud of the exceptional research that our faculty and students are doing, and look forward to hearing more from Vice President Harris, as I'm sure you all will as well, and our presenter, Brian Flower. Next, we'll move to public comment. We recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our parliamentarian. Mr. Perry, have you received any timely request to address this meeting?
Madam Chair, we have no public comment this morning.
Thank you. So next we'll move to university reports. At this point, I would like to ask Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Yvonne Harris, for news items and comments.
Thank you, Chair Herrero. I would like to acknowledge another strong quarter of research funding. As noted in the Sponsored Programs Administration report submitted to the board, NIU-sponsored awards continues to grow steadily, with $11.2 million for research, $5.5 million for instruction, and $5.2 million for other sponsored activities research. When compared to the same period last year, research funded increased by 16% and instructional funding increased by 31%. Unfortunately, due to delays executing several state of Illinois contracts, funding for our other sponsored activities is down by 63% for this quarter. More information and details are provided in the sponsored program's written report. I also want to share with the board that NIU continues to be recognized for its excellence in research. The Department of Energy has recognized the work of one of our faculty and separately recognize the outstanding work of one of our students. NIU physics professor Bella Erdely is receiving $600,000 over 3 years to study a new type of particle accelerator to be used in discovery science. His award and research were posted as a University Research News headline on the Office of Science homepage of the U.S. Department of Energy. At the same time, our NIU physics graduate student, Spencer Kilham, received a prestigious graduate student research award, also from the U.S. Department of Energy. Mr. Kilham is one of 60 students across the United States to receive this highly competitive award that is given for those students who have the potential to make important contributions to the mission of the DOE Office of Science. As part of his award, he will receive a stipend covering travel expenses and $3,600 per month in general living expenses for 1 year period starting this January. He will also begin working at Argonne National Laboratory in Lamont on a full-time basis using electro-optic-based diagnostic tools to analyze particle beams. Next, I would also like to recognize NIU Biological Science Associate Professor Jennifer Koop. Dr. Koop is the recipient of a faculty early career development program called CAREER, grant of $1.2 million over 5 years from the National Science Foundation. Dr. Koop's research involves investigating why some species, specifically parasitic trematode worms, have invaded new habitats. The findings from this research could develop management practices aimed at reducing the negative impact of invasive species on the environment. But what is exciting about this research is the large outreach component that involves NIU graduate students and undergraduate students and seventh grade STEM students at Clinton Rosette Middle School in DeKalb, who are being mentored by the NIU students. Finally, it should be noted that NIU is not only known for its outstanding work in the sciences, but for its research in other areas such as social justice. Professor Zachary Wall Alexander and Jen Jacobs of the College of Education have been awarded $2.55 million by the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice for their work on Project Flex, which leverages the power of sports to change the lives of incarcerated youth. Flex implements evidence-based programming focused on youth physical and mental health, character development, career exploration, and improve access to higher education. The ultimate goal of Project Flex is to reduce recidivism and set youth up for success post-incarceration. Chair Herrero, thank you for this opportunity to share the excellent, innovative work of our faculty and students engaged in research, scholarship, and artistry at NIU.
Thank you, and I just wanna just pause for just a minute. Like, when you really hear that report, I mean, it makes me so proud, like so proud to serve on this board and to be part of this institution, of how we can take our position in research and really, like our values are so embedded in everything. And it's so easy to separate research from values. And that is just not what we do here at NIU. We connect it with our values and we support our values through our research, our practice, instruction, and our partnerships. Our partnerships with employers and partnerships with the K-12 institutions, with other higher ed institutions. I mean, it is just really amazing the role that we are playing in the state with innovation, connection, community building, social justice. I mean, it's everything. It was just such a wonderful report. When I read it, I was like, wow. I just want to really applaud you guys. Really, this is really, really good work.
Veronica?
Yes.
So, just a note to the board here. I don't know if everybody remembers, but Zach Wall, Alexander, and Jen Jacobs were here like probably a year and a half ago talking to us about this project that they were doing on social justice.
Right.
And they just got this award. So that's
it's
pretty
awesome?
Cool to see that come full circle and come back that way.
So
it's
well awesome. Deserved.
Yeah.
So well deserved. Yeah. So thank you for that report. So now we'll really move to university reports. And we'll start with the state legislative report with Ms. Katie Davidson. She's joined us virtually and will be providing a verbal report. Hi, Katie.
Hi, can everyone hear me all right?
Yes.
Great. Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to provide a brief update to the state relations report that you have before you in your board packet. The General Assembly reconvened for the 2024 spring session on January 16th. On Friday, February 9th, the deadline for bill introduction took place, and work is currently underway to identify all bills related to the many aspects of higher education that will come before the General Assembly this spring and share those bills with various areas of the university to identify subject matter experts, determine our position on the bills, and develop a strategy for advancing or halting the advancement of the bills. Budget negotiations at the State House are well underway in preparation for the governor's budget address on February 21st. This year, we will likely see the tightest budget we've seen in some time due to lower than projected revenues and increased demands on spending. At NIU, we are preparing for our Senate and House appropriations hearings, which will likely take place sometime in March, where we will outline our needs and highlight our impact. We're also planning for our third NIU Advocacy Day that will take place in Springfield on March 5th in partnership with the NIU Alumni Association. We invite you to join fellow Huskies to demonstrate the strength and unity of our NIU network and reinforce the impact NIU has had on our students, graduates, and throughout Illinois. The Illinois primary elections will take place on Tuesday, March 19th. Locally, Representative Lance Yednock will not be seeking a bid for re-election, and the primary race for the 76th district has three candidates in the Democrat race, the DeKalb Mayor, Cohen Barnes, Amy Muri Ural, Carolyn Morris Zasada, and two candidates in the Republican race, Liz Bishop and Crystal Loughran. Thank you for your time this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Katie. I just want to say that with regards, I was looking through this report, and as it relates to the IBHE budget recommendations, if I can just make a comment about that. We did, so these are budget recommendations, and I do want to share that, you know, as the four-year trustee at, you know, on the board, and understanding the situation that we do have here at NIU and understanding the needs that we have, you know, there, I did, you know, I want everyone to know that I always advocate for us and for four-year institutions when we're looking at the budget. You know, this year, the reason we came to this number is also, it's not just about the need, but about what we can expect the state to agree on based on where they are and the state that we're in as a whole state. But know that, you know, the needs of this institution and of our other, you know, of our four-year institutions, I do what I can to get that, do the advocacy I need to do there. It's a recommendation. We'll see where the governor falls on this, but fingers crossed we'll at least land here. And any other questions? Yes, Trustee Butler.
I was interested in seeing in the report the mention of the civil service system and a continued desire to see reform, particularly of the residency requirement. I would just mention that at the last Civil Service Merit Board meeting on November 30th, I think we had a kind of a breakthrough. The Employee Advisory Committee spokesperson essentially laid out what that entity would be willing to support, i.e. not produce a significant amount of resistance to lobby against. Changes to that residency requirement, and I think it was the beginning of a framework that was manageable, and what I hope is that we can seize that opportunity and work with those entities in putting forward at least that reform effort. Mm-hmm. And I think what could spoil it would be any kind of system, what I call system-busting efforts, that was just going to get all the same people in line to oppose it, and we're not going to make any progress on what really is a reform that would be meaningful.
Thank you. Thank you for that update. Mm-hmm. Any other discussion or questions for Katie? No? Okay. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
Next, we'll move to agenda item 7B, a federal relations report. Ms. Julia Rowe, who is on virtually here, will provide a verbal report. Hello.
Hi, everyone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to be with all of you virtually. I have a little bit of a longer report this morning, and I did want to note that I will be covering the ongoing issues regarding the FAFSA application at the end of the presentation. Starting with a congressional update on appropriations, we are still currently operating under a continuing resolution at fiscal year 23 levels until March. Negotiations for full year funding measure are still ongoing. The president's budget request is expected to be released on March 9th for FY25. Congress continues to be focused on a border security and foreign aid funding package. The president's alliance, of which MIU is a member, urged Congress to include DACA protections in any changes to border policy, which are currently not in the negotiations. On the legislative side, there's been a lot of activity. On December 16th, the House passed the Deterrent Act, which I mentioned in my December report, modifying Section 117 of the VHEA around foreign gift reporting. The bill has not been taken up in the Senate Health Committee yet or moved to the Senate floor. Also in December, the House Education Committee moved the Bipartisan Workforce Pell Act out of the committee, which would have allowed students to use a new Pell Grant expansion for short-term workforce development training programs and of all types of institutions, including online and for-profit schools. This year, January 31st, the House Education Committee marked up and passed out of the committee the College Cost Reduction Act, introduced by Chairwoman Fox. This bill focuses on accountability, transparency, and affordability measures. It includes changes to accreditation, prohibits the executive and the Department of Education from making any future regulations around student debt, includes upfront price guarantees for institutions, includes data, enhanced data collection and reporting on college outcomes, increases a promise grant program, sunsets the Pell Loan program, and limits borrowing up to the median cost of college, among a host of other provisions. Prior to the markup on January 31st, Ranking Member Bobby Scott of Virginia introduced a package of seven bills called the Roadmap to College Student Success as a Democratic response to the College Cost Reduction Act. The Democratic package doubles the maximum Pell grant to $14,000, expands Pell programs to graduate schools, improves data systems and waives tuition and fees for two-year community college programs. While we've seen a lot of legislative movement in higher ed in the past couple months, I don't expect that any of these bills will become law this year or that we'll see transformational changes to higher ed this Congress. Moving to a Department of Education update, on February 4th, the department finally sent its long-anticipated Title IX rule to the Office of Management and Budget Review. This is a critical step in finalizing the rule. OMBE reviews can take upwards of 90 days, but we do expect the final rule to be issued soon. The department is still reviewing its athletics eligibility rule change, and that rule has not been sent to OMBE yet. As it is in the election year, we expect Congress to slow their action through late spring into the summer months as members begin to return home for campaign season. As a reminder, all members of the Illinois Congressional Delegation are up for re-election in the House, but neither Senator Durbin or Duckworth are up for cycle. And finally, turning to the FAFSA issues, on December 31st, the department finally released their newly updated FAFSA form. As I'm sure you've all seen, there were widespread issues with logging into, completion of the form, incorrect data, incorrect income adjustments on the form nationwide. These and other issues will result in the department delaying transmitting data to institutions until March. We typically get this information in January, and this is what we use to determine students' financial aid offers, giving our financial aid office less time to finalize those offers. On the 5th, the department announced some flexibilities and support for institutions around FAFSA. I've been working closely with Saul to understand the impacts to NIUs and how we can best serve students. He can answer any technical questions on what NIU has done to prepare and communications at FAFSA. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I'll start with a question that I know probably Saul is anticipating, right? What are we doing to mitigate the impact on our students? Thanks, Saul.
Wow, Saul, fancy seeing you here.
Thanks, Chair Herrero. I want to say an appreciation to Julia as well. She continually is sending information our way with various updates. We've been communicating with our student population, both current and prospective students and parents and families, really since the first announcement about that there was going to be some delays. And then, of course, as we receive more information, we continually communicate. So this most recent announcement that institutions will not receive the financial aid information from students until we're expecting mid-March. There's no guarantee it's coming even by mid-March either. So we've been communicating, again, with those same populations. We continue to not only share the updates of what an expected timeline could be, because I think it's important to not only educate our students and families that there are these issues, although I'm confident that probably a lot of them are somewhat aware, but I think it's also important to recognize that just because there are delays with the information coming back to us, there should not be delays in them actually completing the FAFSA. And so, you know, that's something that we have also been seeking as we communicate with our students, is complete the FAFSA now, mm-hmm. and don't delay. Some of the critical decisions that I want to just update you all on is that in alignment with ISAC, when they initially had a February 1st priority deadline for MAP grants, they pushed that back to April 1st. And so in alignment with ISAC, we made the decision to also push back our priority deadlines for AIM High programs like Husky Pledge, our Rockford Promise, other programs that also used to have a February 1st priority date. We wanted to make sure that we pushed that back. We've also communicated that although we don't have a May 1st confirmation or enrollment deadline like a lot of institutions do, but we also know that a lot of students, just even across the country, have that date in mind, and it is, you know, sort of a national decision date for many populations. And we've also let them know that we are not expecting that in any communication that we've had. We're not utilizing that May 1st date, even if we had before, as sort of a softer encouragement. So we've pushed that back and tried to, you know, let everyone know that, especially here at NIU, that we are going to be very flexible, and we understand that it's not the students' issue. And so NIU's position on this is that we are going to continue to work with them. I'll note that at the beginning of the semester, for when our students returned, our financial aid office hosted, for the first 2 weeks, hosted financial aid completion workshops within the office. And there were several hundred students that we helped to complete the FAFSA during those first mm-hmm. couple of weeks. And we continue to offer our services. We work with ISAC very closely to make sure that, you know, ISAC is out, you know, kind of beating the drum too across the state. And we are partnering as much as we possibly can with them as well to make sure that NIU is represented and making sure that students, both current and prospective, understand our flexibility and our willingness to work with them. I will say, at least on a positive side, that NIU has, I think, is seen at least regionally as somewhat of an expert here. I personally have done 3 or 4 interviews with local media in Rockford and NPR, and again trying to share with them and their audiences the position that I've just stated with you this morning.
Thank you. And I did catch some of the coverage, and I was excited to see you quoted. So I think let me ask you this. So once we get past these operational mishaps, right? This should be good for our students, right? The changes that were made should be good for our students.
Yes, absolutely. These changes, I do believe, should help. It really just depends, right? We don't know yet. Okay. I'll just say that. Obviously, what we do know is that we expect, and even the Department of Education has said, that we expect to have across the country a lot more students mm-hmm. that are eligible for Pell and for full Pell. Mm-hmm. We just don't know. We're unable to, without the information, we're unable to do any kind of modeling here internally to see how it will impact mm-hmm. students. One of the other changes with the FAFSA, though, is that they are taking other things into account differently. Yeah. Most notably, the number of students or in the family that are enrolled in college. Yeah. As well as a different way of approaching small businesses and those that own farms. Mm-hmm. And some of those could have a more detrimental impact on some of our students. And so I think those are the things that there are going to be some that are going to receive additional aid, and there may be some who are currently enrolled that are not going to receive as much aid.
If I could just add to that one point, the national higher ed organizations have been very clear in bringing communities of presidents and chancellors together to point out that the Department of Ed has indicated that there is latitude during this transition period for offices of financial aid to look at individual circumstances of current students and make decisions that allow them to stay in school. So the Department of Ed has granted some flexibility during the transition period, and the presidents and chancellors in Illinois have asked ISAC and the IBHE staff to make sure that they message to not only the presidents and chancellors, but also leaders of financial aid offices, that this latitude exists and that there is the opportunity and expectation that we will serve our students to the extent possible.
That's an important message, for sure. Any other questions for Saul or Julia?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Saul, thanks for coming up. So I'm kind of curious, why are we singling out, or why is the government singling out farms and small businesses when it comes to FAFSA? What's the reason?
Julia.
I would not be able to answer that. I don't know if Julia has anything on the insider.
I think it was an adjustment in how they looked at family assets, and those, I think, are typically the largest assets that a family has. So I haven't seen what the formula changes, but that I think the policy would be taken out into account as a family's income.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Trustee Butler.
So are the issues that are referred to in the report, the widespread delays, the issues logging on and completing the form, are those resolved? Is there any reason to believe that a bunch of students walked away from that process and, don't know that those issues have been fixed, or maybe those issues haven't been fixed? I guess this is my question.
Well, I know that there, especially in Julia's report, that when the FAFSA originally launched late December, early January, there were some significant issues and challenges. We have folks in the room who have completed the FAFSA who could give personal stories on this. My understanding is some of those initial issues have been fixed. There's not as long of delays for students and families. Part of our communication is also trying to instruct our students on the best way of going through the process, because we have learned just from personal experiences that there are better ways of completing the FAFSA, because it does require a student and a parent or guardian, and there's an order that is preferred there. So I think that's part of our education as well. My understanding, and I don't know if Julia can speak to this, if there's been any changes related to this, but I know that there had been some significant concerns and may still be with students who may be undocumented that are still requiring some information that the Department of Education system is still not been able to accommodate.
Oh, wow.
I believe that issue remains ongoing. I believe that the department is still asking for that information. And I think it's been raised by many higher ed associations that that is technical fix needs to be changed as well. But I believe that hasn't been fixed yet.
Yeah, I'll just add one more thing to, the president was mentioning about what we call professional judgment within the financial aid office. We also did see, we received notification a couple of days ago that it seems like the Department of Education is going to lighten up a little bit on some of the verification rules this year as well. So similar to the time during COVID where they also lifted some of the restrictions that quite frankly really do have a negative or an impeding impact, especially on students or families from underrepresented communities.
For sure. It's a horrible process.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Trustee Athis.
I just wanted a little more explanation from you and Julia on the expansion of the Pell Grants. to online or to not, or for-profit institutions and for short-term training? And how does that impact the Pell money that's available for more traditional types of programs?
So in the, for this proposal, it's essentially expanding the number of schools that will be eligible for Pell funding. One of the larger issues that NIU has in this bill is that it doesn't tie to an increase in the base Pell pot. So we foresee this being an issue that the number of Pell dollars is the same, however, the number of institutions for students eligible for Pell would expand. So I think that was part of the issue that NIU has with this proposed legislation, is that it doesn't tie to more Pell funding in Congress.
Okay.
So Congress would need to allocate more money to the Pell program to keep those dollars the same with more institutions eligible.
Okay, that was my concern, so I'm glad we're addressing that.
Yeah, that's one of our objections.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? No. Okay. Thank you, Saul, and thank you, Julia, for your leadership here. I know it's not fun to have to, well, you're not fixing our issues. You're sort of figuring out how to fix things that others have complicated for us. So just thank you for your leadership on this. I know this was not what you expected to be spending so much of your time on these days. So thank you very much. And thank you, Julia. Next, we'll move to agenda item 7C, sponsored program administrative quarterly report. Oh, actually, there's no verbal report. There's a written report that Dara has provided. We'll see if any questions from the board. Any discussion? No, we're good. Okay. Next, we'll move to agenda item 7D then. This is a presentation, Northern Illinois University Edible Campus Program, an example of food systems innovation collaborations. So if, Brian Flower, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, everybody. Welcome. Thank you, trustees, distinguished faculty and administration. Much appreciate the time to talk about the Edible Campus Program. Okay, so we have it on the screen. Wonderful. And I have a clicker. I'm supposed to point this at Tony and hope to goodness it works, right? So obviously, my name is Brian Flower. I'm the Assistant Director of Food Systems Innovation at Northern Illinois University, and I'm also the Director of Edible Campus. So I want to take you on a little journey of the rapid evolution of the Edible Campus program. It started in December of 22, and to this date, it has reached all parts of campus, and it's advanced to stages that we could not have imagined when we first built it. There we go. The magic words. Okay. So in December of 22, the initial funding came from the Small Business Association's Congressional Funding Grant through Senator Dick Durbin's office into the Office of Outreach and Engagement. This is a collaboration between Research and Innovation and the Office of Outreach and Engagement. And when we received this money, our goal was to transform parts of the campus grounds into edible landscaping, with the goal of being able to build a living learning laboratory of education, experience, research, for not only our students, but for our faculty and for our community. There is this narrative that the students of this day and age are disconnected from our food systems. So with this program, we hope to, you know, point them in the right direction to get back on the bandwagon of understanding and connecting the dots between, you know, health and wellness and the food system. We also aim to work alongside Dr. Courtney Gallagher in working towards meeting the university's campus sustainability initiatives. And then most importantly, we look to reduce food insecurity issues that are faced by students and our community. So, in December of 22, when we received the funding, obviously it was winter and we couldn't begin growing anything. So between then and the first shovel in the ground, I felt it was imperative to go out and find as many champions as we could to make this program self-sustaining at the conclusion of the funding. So as you can see on the slide, there's a number of them there. Illinois Farm Bureau and Feeding Illinois donated 200 raised beds. Garden Prairie Organics donated 40 yards of compost, which is half of what we used. We used 80 total last year and will continue to donate yearly, provided the program continues. Our local Gordon Hardware provided thousands of dollars of tools. And Ball Horticulture and Baker Creek have been so kind to donate all the seeds that we need to make this program work. I'd like to also give a big thanks to Dave Holliday and Dan Coonan. Dave Holliday, the superintendent of grounds, and Dan Coonan, the director of food service operations, for their partnerships and their collaboration on what we do. So, as you see, I also realize that we are limited in our greenhouse space on campus. And so, as a farmer myself, I know a lot of the FFA folks in town, and so I reached out to the FFA faculty at our local high schools, knowing that each of those high schools had greenhouses, and developed a partnership where we would donate the seed that we got to them. In return, they would grow the seedlings for us, and then they could keep the rest of the seedlings and use them for their plant sales and to help generate revenue for their programs. So with Sycamore, Caneland, Rochelle, and DeKalb High Schools, we managed to get all of the seedlings that we needed to plant in 2023. We started out by building 74 raised beds along the west side of the Founders Memorial Library. These are what we call our free-to-pick beds. And we estimate that around 500 pounds of food have been harvested in those beds to date. They've been warmly received by community members, students, and faculty. And so it's been a great success. There we go, just some extra shots. So, understanding the cultural diversity of our school, we knew that we needed to grow a huge diversity of food to meet those cultural diversities. And so as you can see, and it should be progressing in terms of the pictures, but it's not, we grew a large variety of produce, there we go, to meet those cultural diverse needs that we have. As you can see, peppers, tomatoes, onions, there was a little bit of everything for everyone in there. And you did see a tomato that was 2 pounds, just go by that, just for FYI. So we also placed 26 of the first 100 beds in front of Stevens Hall, and those beds are part of the EMVS 210 program, and they use that to learn square foot gardening methods. That's part of the Sustainable Food System Certificate Program that the Institute for the Study of the Environment, Sustainability, and Energy offers. And the students get a huge kick out of that. And not only do they plant in those gardens, then they come and they help us in the balance of the gardens that we have around campus. In late April, we realized that we needed to turn our attention to building a high-intensity market garden behind Anderson Hall to begin growing volume of produce for not only the campus dining program, but for Husky Pantry. So we started to build 5,000 square feet, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's amazing what we can grow. 5,000 square feet of no-dig, no-till beds that are 30 inches wide, 8 inches deep. And as you can see, we had quite a number of students in late April helping us build those initial beds. These beds are typical of specialty crop growers around the nation whose business is predicated on high-intensity growing methods. So over the next couple of months, we continued to build those beds, and we built 20 60-foot-long beds constituting the 5,000 square foot. And as you can see, it went from dirt in the heat of summer to a flourishing market garden. We were mindful of what sustainable agricultural practices we wanted to employ. Hence the reason we use organic standards when we grow the produce in the market garden and the free-to-pick beds. We also employ an integrated pest management system. We have a number of bunnies and squirrels on campus that we have to take into consideration. And we've also installed a 5-zone irrigation system with moisture sensing capabilities for water conservation to enable us to be more sustainable in our water usage. Another of our partners is DeKalb County Community Gardens, which are very well known in our area, and with whom we are developing sustainable food systems growing workshops that we can deliver to both our students and our community. You see on the left there an example of a worm farm for composting. We call that a vermicompost system, and those two boxes we installed with the help of DCCG. Along with the workshops, we also provide work opportunities for their Adults with Developmental Disabilities program. And it is a sincere great day when those guys and girls come by and help us work. They're really fun to be around. I didn't stop there. I continue to scout for more champions. I came across Midwest Ground Covers, a local organization who are a wholesaler of plants, compost, and other commercial gardening items, and I convinced them to build a 1,500 square foot hoop house, or as Dr. Amy Jo likes to call it, a caterpillar tunnel. This helps extend our growing season by quite a long margin, and as you can see in the picture, we grew broccoli, radishes, beets, kale, all the way up until late November in that hoop house. It was in July of last year that I was touring a company called Innovative Growers Equipment here in Sycamore. I was talking to them about a different project. But while I was walking around their amazing facility, I spotted the two aeroponic towers. They'd just come in from France, and I asked them what they were planning on doing with them. And they said the company in France had asked them to build a lighting system for the two towers so that they could grow cannabis. And I said, I have a better idea. And not long after that, they showed up at 71 North Partnership with this unit fully built, ready to go to grow food. It has the ability to grow 400 plants per tower. And our goal is not only to grow food with these towers, but to work on research projects with Dr. Kevin Martin. You were asking about size. Square footage, it's 10 by 5. So it takes up a 50 square foot floor space. And it is 10 foot high. In July, I had a conversation with Dr. Kristen Brinterson, who was extremely excited and said, I just spoke with ComEd about STEMFest, and they heard about Edible Campus, and they wanted to know who they could talk to, because they had a program that they called an indoor food production project that they were working on, and they were looking for a partner. 5 months later, on December the 7th, we received our $200,000 Edible Campus hydropod. So this hydropod is in partnership with EPRI, the Electrical Power and Research Institute. And EPRI are doing a research program around the country in partnership with resource providers, electrical providers. And what they're doing is they're determining the feasibility of these units for food desert areas by determining power usage, yield, and so on. And so they were looking for a fourth partner for the Chicagoland region. They'd already secured three. And this is in partnership with ComEd, as I mentioned. ComEd purchased four of these units. And after a nice conversation with ComEd and EPRI, they said, and I used the place for the fourth one. And so we received the unit, as I said, in December. So the goal is that they will monitor the unit for 16 months of production. And at the conclusion of the 16 months of production, we'll be able to gain the data that they have received, as well as they'll be able to use it for their research. And then the container is ours to keep. The unit will also provide amazing engaged research opportunities for the university. And it has the ability, when fully operational, to produce up to 100 pounds of leafy greens per week. So no small amount of greens. It'll also give our students unique employment opportunities and great field trips for high schools and local community members. And on the day that it arrived, both President Freeman and Trustee Strom came and visited the unit and took some selfies, which was great. So Edible Campus understands the need for student involvement and community engagement. And to that end, we've achieved the following. We've created numerous volunteer opportunities for both students, student organizations, faculty, staff, and local community members, and other community organizations, other businesses. We are one of only two units on campus that are part of the Huskies Give Back program, where full-time employees can donate 7.5 hours of paid time to Edible Campus. We gave the Honors Program students an opportunity to provide 12 hours of volunteerism as part of an experiential class requirement. We've created numerous student worker positions, and in partnership with Dr. Renault and Dan Coonan, we did two fundraisers featuring ingredients from the Edible Campus that we managed to raise $10,000 from for both the Husky Pantry and the Edible Campus. As part of a partnership with Jessica Sima and the Pick Museum of Anthropology, we created the Preservation Program, which is where we take product out of the market garden and we offer workshops on how to preserve those items. The participants in the workshops get to take something with them, and the balance we put into the Husky Pantry as a value-added product for them. And most importantly, we built the Meal Prep Program. So the Meal Prep Program is where students who don't have access to a kitchen get the opportunity to come, learn how to cook a meal, and make 5 meals using ingredients from the market garden in cooperation with ingredients that our partner, Undeniably Dairy, who are another sponsor of ours, help provide. And so far, well, I'll give you the numbers in a minute, but so this is a great program, and the students that have done this have said that it's made a significant difference for them in the amount of meals that they can have during the week, especially before classes. And obviously, we need to get our educational and research programs involved, and as you can see, I'm not going to read the list, but some of the highlights, the ones that I'm really interested in, the relationship with Dr. Kevin Martin, both on the aeroponic towers, and we're going to get him involved in the hydropod. Dr. Bill Martin, we've been chosen by the Land Institute to do a civic science research program on perennial grains. And this came about from another program that I operate, which is the Innovation Conversation Series. We had the Land Institute be part of that, and so we got connected with them, which was great. From the College of Visual and Performing Arts, we had Dr. John Siblick build an outdoor installation around the gardens next to the library, which is extremely amazing. It's a great art installation. And another one that I'm really happy and looking forward to is the partnership with Dr. Beth Galliard and using the MAC lab to determine nutrient density on the product that we grow in all the different environments and the difference between heirloom seeds that we get from Baker Creek and traditional seeds that we get from Boala Horticulture. So how do we impact the students? Well, there's experiential opportunities for the students. They have the opportunity to get their hands in the dirt, learn how to grow for themselves. They can learn preservation techniques and how to provide themselves with a week's worth of healthy meals. And then all of the produce that we grow either goes to campus dining, the Husky Pantry, the meal prep program, or the preservation program, and in turn goes back to the students. So in terms of impact assessment, in our first year, we grow over 3,000 pounds of fresh, nutrient-dense produce in the market garden alone. We facilitated the production of over 700 free meals to students as part of the meal prep program. We've provided fresh ingredients to over 9,000 plates of food through campus dining services and the Husky Food Pantry. We've worked with numerous faculty and staff across the university and had a bounty of volunteers assist us in building the program. We managed to acquire thousands of dollars in donations, both in kind and monetary, and the number you see on the screen, that does not include the Hydropod when we actually receive that. So you might ask, how do we get the word out about Edible Campus? We started by building an Edible Campus website, and I'd like to put a thank you to Rachel Zedes and her team. They built an amazing website for us that really speaks to the work that we're doing. And this year in January, Dr. Amy Jo Clemens, the Assistant Vice President for Outreach, and myself, we went to Everything Local Conference in Springfield with 700 participants and presented on Edible Campus. We've been included in a three-part docuseries funded and produced by the Illinois Farm Bureau called Fields Apart, Rooted Together. The first series is actually out already, and we'll be notified. They partnered with three universities, SIU, Western Illinois, and NIU. And I will just make a comment on that. When the producers and all of the camera crew came to NIU to do the interview, and they looked around, they said, we need to let you know, we've been on every campus in the state of Illinois, nobody's doing this. Ag schools have farms that are disconnected from the campus grounds themselves, but nobody else is doing this. And then recently, Jessica Shima and myself presented about the Edible Campus and the Preservation Program at a STEM cafe, where we had over 100 folks and standing room only at Fatty's, which was great. And then this year, we've been invited to Baker Creek's annual festival in Missouri to present on Edible Campus and the Preservation Program itself. And then for those of you who got to see it this week, we were on Channel 13 News, WREX. The Hydropod was featured, and there was an article in there about it. So where do we go from here? We're going to continue to add 100 free-to-pick beds each year around campus. And we're looking at Neptune West this year. We're currently working on creating micro-credentialing and non-credit certification opportunities and additional classes for credit with both EMVS and the College of Health and Human Sciences. And we're working to find funding to add a 1,000-square-foot greenhouse to help us with succession planting, as our high schools are not in session when we need our early fall plants. As the program grows, we'd like to add areas that are focused on nut and berry production to make it truly an edible landscape. And we'd like to build and operate a vegan vegetarian food truck on campus. Gaining on the momentum of Food Truck Wednesdays that were extremely popular last semester when it first started. And the university doesn't have a vegan vegetarian restaurant dedicated, and the produce that we grow, it would kind of lend itself. We recently applied for the Illinois Local Food Infrastructure Grant to build the Husky Mobile Aggregation Unit, and there's the whole story behind that as well. I could go into many details, but we hopefully will get the funding for that. In keeping with the university's sustainability initiative, we're looking to build a 3-bay compost system by the Market Garden. And finally, we aim to double the Market Garden in 2024 to double production. So in conclusion, I believe the Edible Campus is the embodiment of the university's vision and mission. It's an engine for innovation to advance social mobility, promote personal, professional, and intellectual growth, and transform the world through research, artistry, teaching, and outreach. It also has the ability to empower students through experiential learning and engage communities for the benefit of the region, state, nation, and the world. And thank you. And if you have any questions, I'm more than willing to answer them.
so exciting. I'm sure my colleagues here have questions.
Sure.
I have one question that I'll start us off with, which is obviously the experience that you're creating here is incredible and can be leveraged in so many different ways with so many different stakeholders. Is there a vision at all to, as we're, I'm thinking of transfer students and just overall pathways from high school through to bachelor's degree programs, and how we build the pipeline for more folks in agriculture, in like food innovation and sustainability. Are we talking at all about how we work with community colleges and high schools on the early college side, building pathways there through the local community college to the bachelor's degree here, using these grounds, right, as the hands-on experience and the engaging part of the program?
I have talked with a number of different community colleges. President Freeman and myself, we were at McHenry County Community College, who have an agrarian program there, looking at ways that we can leverage what we're doing with Edible Campus to make it a pathway for students to come from community colleges to be part of EMVS and the Sustainability Food System Certificate Program. But it's, understanding that NIU is not an ag school is not a barrier to entry for this, because food systems apply to everybody. And we have everything on campus that we need to make this a success.
Yeah, I'm going to tell a little story on Brian here.
Good.
So I think the board knows that, we are going to be offering programs at McHenry New University Center in Harvard, and they ask for the programs that are the typical transfer pathways.
Yep.
And I was very excited when I was going to go and talk to their president and their academic leadership that they also had a really substantial greenhouse effort ag entrepreneurship program.
Yep.
And I said to them, well, I'd really like to bring Brian Flowers with us to talk about maybe paths from, the AAFs and 3+1s. And they're like, oh, we know Brian. We participate in your innovation conversation. And he's already been up to look at our greenhouses. And so, Brian, as you could see from all of the connection, gets around. And the coming together separately, I think that one community college could be a model for many, many others. And I agree with you, there are just terrific pathways to be had here.
Right, because there's some certain sectors and programs like food systems that are so abstract to young people, and yet when you bring it to life like this, you allow the young people to really understand what it is. So I think what we have here is could be incredibly powerful as we think about how we build a pipeline and interest in.
I think the food truck piece is a particularly important one.
Mm-hmm.
McHenry has a food truck entrepreneurship program. I think as you look at where food-related businesses start, it's often there. Certainly in terms of access to communities that have difficulty getting food, food trucks make a big difference. We saw that, in Jada Juice when she talked about storefronts, but food trucks. And so I think we have tremendous opportunities to take this to the next level, engage transfer students, engage people who might not have found this pathway otherwise, and continue to be consistent with our mission, vision, and values.
Yes, thank you. Other comments or questions?
Yes. Chair Gibb.
I could not help but think about how we could expand this thing outside of the university campus. We don't know each other, but I've got a background working at the CHA. And the first thing I think about is the poor health choices, food choices that are available at in public housing sites. The ability, and a lot of this is because you're so used to eating processed food or fast food, they don't know how to eat,
mm-hmm.
right? And it causes a number of other lingering illnesses that occur from whatever to, bottom line is the folks don't get good food and it causes right. other health related issues. How portable is something like this to an All Guild Gardens in Illinois, outside of Chicago, where mm-hmm. you've got plenty of open space, land to plant crops, et cetera, and possibly funding from HUD.
Mm-hmm.
When we first started talking about this program, we realized that if we could successfully do this, and I mean, what we've done in the first year, it's been a lot. And, you know, we realized that if you think of institutions, I mean, you go to any of the businesses that have large landscaping around their business, if they were smart and just transferred it into something such as this, and then got their staff involved, mm-hmm. not only could they reduce insurance policy issues, that, I mean, they would be saving thousands on landscaping. So yes, this is extremely mobile. Could this be done in other places around? Of course. And the Husky Mobile Aggregator, I can tell you a little bit. So the Illinois Infrastructure Grant is for $150,000, and it has to be an infrastructure piece that helps, not just the entity that's building it, but the community. Mm-hmm. We don't have a lot of gardens, but what we do need as we grow is the ability to wash, clean, and pack and refrigerate yes. our produce. Farmers and specialty crop growers spend thousands of dollars on building these facilities to do that. So I thought, well, why don't we put it on wheels? And then not only can we use it, but other, you know, young farmers that are trying to get into the industry who don't want to spend that money on the infrastructure could call and say, can we lease your mobile aggregator for the day? Yeah, of course. We'll send the team down with the unit. And so that's what we're hoping to do with that unit, is to build a wash, clean, and pack unit on a trailer and pulled by a refrigerated truck mm-hmm. that not only can we use, but we can let other members of the community.
Do me a favor and keep that idea of potential sponsorship through HUD and the CHA open, because I know that they would be receptive to this idea.
Sure, thank you.
Mm-hmm. What are the other three locations? Can you share for the hydropods?
For the hydropod, yeah, Grow Greater Englewood, the Emerald South Economic Development Collaborative, and the Young Men's Educational Network of Lawndale okay. are the three mm-hmm. of the units. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And I feel for those folks. I mean, if any of you have worked in Chicago, you understand how the city works. And oh, yeah. one of the units, they had to get water from one side of the street to the other. So it's thousands of dollars, you know, tearing up the streets, directional drilling, and so on. But we are now at the stage where the monitoring and verification systems are going to be installed the week of March the 4th and 5th, because EPRI sends a team to do all of the units in 1 week. Mm-hmm. So they have to wait till all of the units are ready before they can send their team. It's a 2-day process, it's a day and a half process. But they're sending two technicians simultaneously to work on all four units. And then when the M&V systems are in, then the training will begin. We'll be getting our training for the unit on March the 14th and 15th. It's a Thursday and Friday the following week. And once again, Freight Farms, who are the designers of these units, they're the ones that are going to send the team down, and they wait till everybody's ready before they'll send the team down.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Is there a question over here? Oh, yes, Trustee Strom.
Brian, thank you again for the presentation. And yes, back in December when that pod arrived, it was the day we were here. And thank you for the quick tour of it that afternoon. And your comment about NIU not being an ag school is not a barrier to this, and I could not agree more with that. You know, the DeKalb area has such a rich history in agriculture, and it just makes total common sense that this university, with the issues around food systems, one of the biggest challenges that our society faces for the next future generations is going to be feeding the world population with, in face of climate issues, challenges, and a number of other issues related to food production. So instilling the opportunity for students that come here to get a glimpse of the importance of the food system, whether you're in the business school or you're in the
yes.
engineering school or you're in the law school here. I mean, the agriculture and food systems around the globe is the world's largest economy, in essence. And so I you know, I applaud the efforts on this. As Lisa knows, here a month ago, we had a quick meeting. I'm working to try to get the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, to come here to campus either later this spring or early fall to see and be part of what's going on here. And it's looking favorable this time, but schedules are always a bit of a challenge. I think it's important that NIU continue to move forward in this because, again, whether it's a climate, water-related issues, or whatever the issue, it so many times ties back to agriculture. One specific question I have on this is around food safety. And having been in agriculture all my life and working in food systems as well, food safety issues are a key. How are you dealing with or mitigating any of the issues around food safety with the produce that you produce here on campus? Because there's a legal aspect to that and regulation.
Yeah. So we utilize the Gilbert kitchens that are not being utilized for dorm food service, and we use the kitchen space for refrigeration, for aggregation of all the produce, so it goes directly from the gardens, directly into Gilbert dining halls, kitchen space. It's immediately washed, cleaned, packed, and put into refrigeration, ready for use and transportation. And then we partner with campus dining services to move the food from location to location. And so it's even with the mobile aggregation unit, you know, of course, we'll be following all the necessary FSMA regulations and GAP certification in order to make, because if we're going to utilize that unit, not just for us, but for external entities, that needs to be certified.
Okay, that is helpful. I was curious on the FSMA and the GAP certifications that you were meeting all those.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's funny, I mean, Secretary Vilsack was, I remember, not long after the pandemic, he came out and openly admitted, we need to think about regionalizing our food systems and decentralizing our food systems, and this is a showcase of exactly that. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Appreciate it.
Second, Wozowitz.
Thank you, Trustee Wozowitz. Rachel, will you please call the roll call?
Committee Vice Chair Athas?
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Farsima?
Yes.
Trustee John Butler?
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Yes.
Oops. Trustee Tim Moore?
Yes.
Trustee Leland Strom?
Yes.
Trustee Eric Wozowitz?
Yes.
Committee Chair Veronica Herrero?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. The meeting is now adjourned. This concludes the Research, Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Affairs Committee. Thank you.